Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Professor Per Billund. Per is Associate Professor of Entrepreneurship and the Johnny D. Pope Chair in the Spears School of Business at Oklahoma State University, and he's a Senior Fellow at the Mises Institute. He is the author of three books, most recently, How to Think About the Economy, a Primer. That's a short and very concise but all very powerful little book that can introduce you to the economic way of thinking from the Austrian perspective. And here joining us today is Per to talk about this book and about education of economics and Austrian economic ideas in particular. Per, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Great having you back. So tell us, what was your idea behind writing this primer? Why did you decide to do it? It's a very concise little book.
Yeah, and it's sort of a competitor to your book, your recent book, right? I have to sell it really well.
The thing about readers is that they don't just read one book. So I think it's more like a complementary good, because if you write a good book about something, then people are going to want to learn more about the topic and they're going to read more. So I don't think of it as a competitor as much as it is a compliment. I think people could read the smaller book and then become interested in the bigger book, or they could read the bigger book and then want the smaller book to give to their children or to friends who might not want to read the whole thing. So I think knowledge is a non-rival good in many ways.
Well, I think that is true for sure. So yeah, and I think they are pretty good as compliments too. I tried to do something different because yours is much longer, like you mentioned. And what I set out to do was try to have this one perfect, more or less, starting point to learn something about the economy. So even if you have taken courses in economics, or perhaps especially if you've taken courses in economics, you don't know anything about economic reasoning. You don't really have the intuition that economists in the Austrian school and economists in the early days actually had. And I'm sure you get the same question as I do all the time, that, what is this one thing I should read to get sort of up to date or learn a little bit about Austrian economics before I start reading the big treatises? And very often people would say Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson or something like that. And I mean, that's a great book, but it is just one lesson. It's nothing else. And it's that one lesson over and over and over again in 35 chapters or whatever it is. You really understand opportunity cost and the seen and the unseen after you've read that book, but you don't really get an idea of the pricing mechanism, the overall allocation of resources, business cycles, the impact of regulations, and in general on the standard of living and things like that. They're not really covered much in Hazlitt's book and other introductions to Austrian economics. They're often very academic or published by academic publishing houses, which means they're like $100 or up. And they might be a little lengthy. They might use jargon. They might start talking about the history of the Austrian school rather than actually introduce you to how to think about the economy. So you get to learn about how Karl Menger published this book in 1871, and then there was a second generation and so forth. And I mean, all of this is fine, but if you want to quickly get a grasp of what the heck is economics about and how does the economy actually work, there really was nothing. So I suggested to Jeff Deist, then the president of the Mises Institute, to write a primer and publish a primer. And he thought it was a good idea and he thought I should do it. And the aim should be to make it like really short, so no longer than half of Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. And that's already a pretty short book. And make it really simple, no jargon at all. And when I wrote it, I mean, it was really hard to try to find the level, but I tried to write it so that you can give a copy to your grandma and your grandma should be able to understand it. That was sort of the point or the aim of the book.
Yeah, I think it does a good job with that. And as you say, I think it fills an important gap in the markets. It's difficult to find something that can just communicate some of these key ideas briefly. Not everybody, believe it or not, this might be hard to believe for some of my listeners, but not everybody gets really excited about digging into thousands of pages of Mises and Rothbard. Some people apparently think they have better things to do with their lives. I wonder what that might possibly be. But, you know, until at least they realize the error of their ways, you do have an issue where it is kind of difficult to get them to dig into something so elaborate. Because on many topics, for instance, business cycle, there's so many resources that you could give to explain the Austrian business cycle. And yet, at the same time, there isn't something that is very brief, concise, gets to the point. There's several articles by Rothbard. There are many chapters in different books. You could use America's Great Depression. It's a great place to teach this. You could reuse Roger Garrison's textbook, but it's extremely elaborate and extremely sophisticated, and it's kind of too academic. But there's still something very profound there that you could communicate to somebody in a few pages without having to go and dig into something extremely sophisticated like Garrison's work. And that's basically what you do. So I think it's very good that you've done it. I look forward to many people reading it and getting hooked on the Austrian perspective.
Yeah, let's hope that happens. I mean, so far it's actually been received very well, and a lot of people have been interested in not only reading it and telling me that they love it, but also buying a bunch of copies and handing out to family members and friends and things like that. So I'm sure it's going to ruin a lot of Thanksgiving dinners.
That's good. Yeah, that's the mark of a successful book. You know, people fight over it over Thanksgiving. That's what you got to aim for. But let's get into the content of the book. So the book begins with explaining what economics is. So tell us, what is economics from your perspective?
Yeah, you know, isn't it funny that you can take economics courses, but no one actually ever tells you what it is? So people would say that economics is the study of the economy, but that doesn't really help much because that just raises the question, what the heck is the economy? And then how do you separate the economy from society overall? It's not that obvious when you think about it that, well, the economy is about buying and selling, or it's about production and it's about goods and services. Yeah, okay, what in society is not really about that? I mean, is where do you draw the line? And why is economics different from sociology or political science or whatever it might be? No one really answers that question. They just take it for granted. And I guess that works if you're sort of quickly rushing through an economics course at the university and you're not thinking of digging deeper, then it's perfectly fine. But I think the economy and the study of the economy, it really deserves a more focused, good definition that the economy is, in a sense, all of us economizing. That's one way that I put it, that we're all trying to attain ends that are really highly valued. We try to make our lives better off, and we have scarce resources to do that. And we somehow together needs to figure out how to satisfy all of us to the greatest degree possible. And that's not all that easy, which of course that means that it's really much about production. So we produce goods and services, we produce experiences, we produce all of these things. So we use resources, and through production, we make them much more useful to us so that we can satisfy more wants, so we can get a much higher standard of living. And that's really what we've been seeing the past 200 or 300 years with industrialization and now the so-called information economy and things like that, where our lives today are at a so much higher standard of living than they were earlier. And for thousands of years, we were basically the same. Nothing changed much. Even the population didn't grow much. But the past couple of hundred years, the population of the world has increased by a lot. And as a consequence, we're not in sort of a Malthusian trap where we're all starving because we can't produce enough food. Instead, we're struggling with obesity because people are eating too much and the wrong things. So it's not the case that we are sort of doomed to be poor, and that there is a strict relationship between, and a fixed relationship between, resources and value outcome. That's obviously not the case if you look at what happened in the world. So explaining that whole process rather than just explaining what we can see right now is the core of economics, trying to figure out where does growth come from. In a sense, Adam Smith sort of captured it in the title of his treatise, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, right? That why are some countries rich? Why are some countries not as rich? Why do some catch up to the rich countries? Where the heck does this wealth come from? How was it created? Who created it? And questions like that. Those should be at the core of when we study the economy. In order to understand what is going on, that is where we must start and what we must look at.
Yes, indeed. And so then you move on to discussing economic theory. What is economic theory from your perspective, or from the Austrian perspective, I'd say?
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Well, it's a bunch of statements, I guess you could say, or economic laws we typically refer to them as. And it's really a framework for understanding what the heck is going on. But it's not like theory in the natural sciences, where theory is sort of supported hypotheses. So they can be debunked at any point in time. As long as we get some other set of data or run some other regressions or whatever, then we find, oops, it wasn't true. There was no gravity. And then we have to change everything. Economic laws are not subject to that kind of test, because they are derived from what it means to act at all. And of course, we act in order to become better off, just like where we started out just a minute ago. And that means that we are replacing our situation for a situation where we think we're going to be better off. And we use means, and we basically invest in trying to get there. Economic theory describes not the content of it. So it's not going to be able to tell us how rich we're going to get. It's going to be not going to be able to tell us how to get rich. It's not going to be able to tell us exactly what it's going to look like, but it's going to help us reason about it and give us structure to understand what is going on. So it's sort of a framework, much like you can think of mathematics or geometry more than a theory in physics or in biology. So nobody says that, oh, well, are you sure that 2 + 2 = 4? We probably need to study this empirically and do some tests, and because that's just a hypothesis. No one would say that. We don't treat mathematics as hypotheses. We treat it as a theory that is true. And that's why it's being applied in natural sciences and social sciences too, even though we can argue that that might not be the right way to do it. But physics without mathematics would be, well, nothing at all. And they rely on mathematics as a framework to help them solve problems and to figure out what is actually going on. So it's really an application of it. And economics is the same. It's an application of logic to understand people's actions and interactions and sort of the structure of the economy overall. So economic theory is just this framework to uncover what is actually happening under our very noses. Because a lot of it, we can't actually observe directly. So we have to have an understanding for it.
Yeah, it grates people greatly when they first hear about the Austrian approach. It's like, no, you can't just make an axiom and then just go ahead and deduce logical implications from it like a psychopath. You have to grapple with data. You have to just spend time on data and then see what the data tells you. And I think there's an unfair criticism here where people think that what the Austrians are saying is that data is pointless, data is useless, empirical analysis is useless. And that's not the case. The case is, in fact, that empirical analysis is pointless and useless and meaningless unless it is guided by, you know, an understanding of the causal mechanisms that are taking place. Because the data on its own, and this is something that, you know, the Austrians share with statisticians who tell you, like really hardcore statisticians rather than the kind of economists who employ statistics in order to arrive at policy relevant conclusions that they want to hear. The actual statisticians will tell you, look, the numbers will never be able to tell you what is causal and what is a correlation that is spurious. Numbers on their own can never decide that. So you could look at a correlation between two factors, and there's absolutely no way to tell just by looking at the numbers which one causes the other. So you'll see an example that I had in statistics class, which stuck with me, is imagine if you have a little, if you buy a little baby cat or you have get a new baby kitten born. And at the same time, there's a construction site next door. They're building a building. And so for the first year or something, the building is growing and your cat is growing. So you could plot the data and you'll find that there's a very strong correlation. It takes, I'm not very good on cat development, but let's assume for the sake of argument that constructing the building takes roughly around the same time as it takes to make the cat into an adult or a dog, whatever. And so, you know, you look, you plot, and the cat is born, the construction starts, you find that there's a correlation. Eventually, they both settle at their final form, and that might happen around the same time. So there's a pretty strong correlation. There's absolutely no way that the data will tell you whether it is the building that is causing the cat to grow or whether it is the cat causing the building to grow. It's impossible that the numbers on their own could ever decipher this for you. It could be, just by looking at the numbers, you cannot say that the one causes the other, and you cannot say that this is just a spurious correlation. The two are just correlated because they happen to have started at the same time. The numbers on their own cannot tell you that. You have to just understand how cats work, and you have to understand how buildings work, and you have to understand that, nope, the building does not make cats grow, and the cat does not make buildings grow. And that's why there is no relationship between the two, no matter what the data says, because you've got a guiding framework of understanding how those things work. And that's I think, a better way of understanding the Austrian objection to a lot of the empirical analysis. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a classical example is of the same thing, really, is that firefighters cause fires. Because they correlate. Whenever you see firefighters, there's usually a fire, and vice versa. So obviously you can say, firefighters, they cause fires, and that's why there are fires. Or it could be that fires cause firefighters, but who knows? You can't really tell which one causes which, and there are no statistical methods for figuring out.
We need more studies.
Yeah, I mean, that's what an academic and a researcher would claim, right? Because that means that they get more funding. So it speaks to their self-interest.
We need to burn down more houses and see what happens. We need to, do a randomized control trial with tens of thousands of houses, burn these down, and then see how many firemen show up and see if there's a statistically different correlation. Yeah.
That's the only way.
Yeah, but from the Austrian perspective, obviously the other main point of the analysis is that it is all driven by the action axiom. We understand that human beings act. Why is this such a big deal in your opinion, or how would you put it? What is so important about the axiom?
Well, I mean, for several reasons. I mean, talking about an axiom is sort of a turnoff for a lot of people already, I think, but it is important to have a starting point, especially for a system that is purely logical. So where you depend on logic to derive what must be true, then your starting point has to be true too. And that is the axiom. And an axiom is a true starting point. And that's why Austrian economic theory is so reliable and basically immune to falsification, if you will. I'm not sure you're allowed to say that, especially when you're talking about science, but you have to have a firm, really reliable starting point if you're going to derive logically truths from it. And the action axiom is that. I think it's important for many reasons. You mentioned one already, causality, because it is based on our understanding as human beings of causality, because any action is trying to achieve something. So you are already applying your pre-understanding for causality, that you can make this change in the world. That is already part of the action axiom, that we act as, and that it's purposeful behavior. We're trying to achieve something. It's also a bridge between what we value personally, which might or might not be something real or something objective. It doesn't really matter, but whatever motivates us to act, that's in our minds. So value is subjective. That's the starting assumption, right? But action is the link between the empirical world and what happens in our heads. So when we act out on what we value most personally, what we imagine is really, really good for us and would be beneficial to us, we are using the real world, whether it's resources or interactions with others or what have you, in order to bring that about. So rather than say, well, value is subjective, so anything goes. That's not much of a science, right? It's about as ridiculous as animal spirits or something like that. So instead of doing that, we can say, well, value is subjective. That's what motivates our actions. And when we act, it has certain impacts on anything external to us as individuals. So other people, the resource allocations, the earth itself, what have you, all those sort of things are impacted somehow in one way or the other by our action. So it's important in that sense too. And of course, it's can you deny that actions exist and that action is purposeful behavior? No, you cannot. And I think it is Hoppe who argued originally that it's a performative contradiction trying to refute it, because what are you doing if you try to refute that action is purposeful behavior? Well, you're purposefully behaving in order to refute action as purposeful behavior. So you're really confirming the concept of action already in trying to refute it, which is a pretty strong reason to accept it as it is. Because if you can't refute it, not because it's circular or anything like that, but because it's necessarily true, and that you have to act in order to show that there is non-action, then why wouldn't you start there? I mean, everything we do as human beings is action, and everything that arises in the economy is due to action, and society too. But that's sort of a broader conception. Economics focuses sort of on the market economy and production part of society.
Yeah, and I think the key point that I would try to make perhaps is that if you think of economics from the perspective of human beings acting, and then you try and understand what are the consequences and what are the logical things that we can deduce as a consequence of their actions, bearing in mind what we know about human beings and how they work, you're able to get a lot more insight into economic questions than if you treated economic questions as if they were being determined by causative factors other than human action. In other words, if you're thinking of economics as being just something that happens because, you know, aggregates of numbers hit certain points and so trigger certain things, it's going to be very different what you arrive at as a conclusion. So in the first chapter of Principles of Economics, the first chapter is also called Human Action, and it tries to explain why Austrian economics is so fixated on this. I make the case that I try and contrast between two different ways of approaching an economic question. You've got the human action way, wherein you're dealing with a question something like minimum wage law. From the human action perspective, you look at the human beings involved and you try and understand how they would react to this law. So from the human action perspective, you think of the employer who is involved in employing somebody. And now that they are forced to pay, say, $10 an hour for the minimum wage, what are they going to do? Well, because they're a human being and they act, they're only going to be hiring people who pay them, who produce value that is more than $10 an hour. Because if you can't pay them less than $10, they have to produce more than $10, or else you lose money for every employer you hire. So you won't hire anybody that you lose money on. And we know this is true because even if you didn't go ahead by it, you're going to lose your business. You're not going to be an employer for long if you keep hiring people that cost you money rather than make you money. And so the market is going to go toward a world in which human action is going to respond to this incentive of not hiring people for less than $10 unless you want to go to jail, by just not hiring people that cost less than $10. And that doesn't mean that you hire them and pay them $10. You just don't hire them at all. Whereas if you'd thought of economics from the macro economic perspective that most universities teach today, you'd think, well, the minimum wage is going to increase the amount of wages that people get paid. And then you're going to have all these mathematical models. You know, each economist has their own models, which they construct of how they think the world works. And then you plug this change into the model and you arrive at the specifications for the world as you think it should be, as you think it would function. And so $10 means that's going to mean that workers are going to be paid, say, $10 billion extra over a year. And that's going to translate to another $8 billion of extra spending. So that's an $18 billion boost to GDP, which is going to result in an increase in employment. And it's going to result in a rise in industrial output. And it's going to result in all kinds of wonderful things. I mean, with these models, you can plug in any kind of assumptions you want and arrive at any conclusion you want, because none of it is scientifically demonstrated. None of it is testable. None of it can be presented as if it is a scientific law. And so you can arrive at, you can use any formula you want and arrive at whatever conclusion that you want. And that's why economists who don't think through human action end up supporting ideas like minimum wage laws, price interventions in general, all kinds of government interventions, because for them, it's all about altering these numbers that exist in some kind of world in which this thing called economy has a GDP and it has an unemployment rate and an inflation rate and an industrial output or whatever. And you connect these numbers together and you can figure out how they affect each other. So if you are not happy about one of them, then see the relationship it has with other things and see if you can pull a lever on one of the other things and then you can raise that. So workers are not getting paid enough. All right, pass a law and then you get the workers' pay to increase. And that kind of mechanistic thinking is essentially physics envy. This is economists acting like physicists, as I see it. And I don't think it is a fruitful avenue of economic analysis. You end up getting lost in all kinds of theories because, you know, you think of yourself as being driven by data, but in reality, you're being driven by the biases of the people who wrote the textbooks on which you're basing those theories, because they come at it with a bias and then they find the data that justifies that bias. So they find all the correlations that they want. They find all the accounting identities and treat them as if they're causal statements. And they ignore the analysis of human action involved in this.
Well, I mean, that's how equations work, right? So they've done all these studies before and they found that these aggregates, however they chose to calculate them, they seem to have some relationship, at least statistically at this point in time. So then you just assume that that is true and you plug that into your model. And then obviously if you have two sides then, and you have spending on one and you have this or that on the other side, then shouldn't it mean that if you increase one variable, the other variables must adjust in one way or the other? That's just a mathematical rule, right? So if you treat the economy that mechanistically, like you said, and thinking of the economy, all peoples with their desires, with their dreams, with their choices to act or not, and whatever it is they're deciding, if you treat that as simply an equation in the aggregate, then you can play the central planner and it's pretty easy too, because you just plug in whatever numbers you want and everything else adjusts to get that number that you plugged in. Of course, the problem is that there are people involved, which is usually why you get such things as market failures and things like that, where you try to create a certain outcome and that doesn't happen because somehow the people don't act as they're supposed to in the model. So the equation doesn't work out. And then usually what economists would do then, or policymakers, they would figure out how to tamper with people's actions, provide them a little incentive here and disincentive there to sort of push them in the right direction to get the outcome that they were looking for, that the first policy tried to create but failed to create. So they add these add-on policies that sort of try to nudge people in one direction or the other so that you get the outcome that you want. And of course, then you're talking about all out dictatorship, trying to just steer people as pawns on a chessboard, basically.
Yeah. And that's really perhaps the really important thing about learning economics might just be that it makes you immune to this kind of propaganda. Some would call it science, but I think propaganda is a more accurate way of looking at it. This kind of collectivist insanity, which takes over societies. Yeah, yeah. If you understood economics, you wouldn't go along with this kind of stuff.
Right. And that's sort of, I think I talk about that in the introduction or the preface or something like that to the book too, that the point of the book is to basically get you to at least a basic level of economic literacy. Not to know any functions, not to know any special models or anything like that, but just to be literate with respect to how the economy functions. Because if you know how the economy works, you understand immediately what is the impact of raising the minimum wage, like you mentioned before. What's going to happen if you raise it a little bit? Why would that raise people's wages if they're in jobs where they produce less value than the wage that people have to pay them now? Then of course that job is going to disappear. Employers aren't going to subsidize them. And if it actually worked, then the obvious solution to poverty would be to raise the minimum wage to $100 or $1,000 or $1 million an hour. And people would just make that much money instead. And we would all be happy and we could have vacations for 9 months out of the year or something like that. And we would all be super happy and have an enormous standard of living. But even the promoters and advocates of minimum wage, they don't want to go that far. So they realize that there's something that is a little fishy with their own reasoning, because it's not just about raising the minimum wage and then people get richer, because there's no end really to how rich people want to be. So why don't they want to go further than, say, $15 an hour, the fight for 15? Why not 20 or 50 or 100 or a million? Well, no, that's unreasonable. Okay, why is it unreasonable? Is it maybe that it causes unemployment? Yes, it does. That's why you can't raise it that much, because then people are going to realize that, whoops, you caused a problem, you didn't solve one.
Yeah, this is one of the things I love about Twitter. A lot of times you'll find these kind of politicians or academics pounding the table figuratively on Twitter, saying we need, you know, minimum wage of $15 or $20 or whatever. And there's always people responding, well, you know, why not 16? Why not 17? And then another guy says, why not 18? If I am elected, I'm going to give you 20. I'm going to give 50. And it's, I think it flies over the head of most of those people, because in their mind, I think you give them too much credit by saying they'll think that it's, you know, why not a million? Because then it's going to create some unemployment. I think in their mind, it's not that sophisticated, the reasoning why they don't ask for a million. They don't ask for a million because the bosses are just going to refuse to pay that much. And so we need to, you know, we're bargaining here. We're trying to get those rich, greedy people who are sitting on all of that money to give a tiny little bit of it. And if we asked for $15 an hour, and we have our politician and their thugs scare those people, you know, the evil employers, of course, insert image of fat cat entrepreneur here, who's out there to just, you know, runs a business just so that he could exploit others. We can hopefully coax $15 an hour out of him. If you can get 1 million, by all means, go ahead. But, you know, those are evil bourgeoisie people who don't like to see workers happy. So they don't pay a million. I think this is as far as the thought process goes. I don't think there's any kind of sophisticated ability to develop an understanding of second order effects. All right, what's going to happen next? It's just, we're trying to bargain with those people, and we think 15 is attainable, so let's rally around it.
Yeah, but even that is a failure, right? I mean, as an academic or researcher, if you think that it's your job to figure out a level where you can get employers to pay people more, you're playing politics, you're playing in normative land rather than being a sort of value-free scholar trying to figure out how things work. So you've already lost. So all you have is basically your credentials and whatever position you have. But what you're speaking about is something that you shouldn't at all be speaking about, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Moving on, what is the market? How do you define that in your book?
Well, that is really the crux of the problem, right? That if economics studies human action as it applies in the market, then we need to define the market as well. And the market is really all the interactions that happen, all the trades, the exchanges that happen. So if we start with any exchange, it's because if you and I exchange some things, it's because I think I'm going to be better off if I get what you have, and I value that higher than what I have and give to you, and you value what I have and offer to you more than what you offer to me in return. So any exchange that happens voluntarily, the expectation of the parties is that they're going to be better off. And we have all of these exchanges happen all over the place. That is the market in itself. But it's also the case that we produce things in order to facilitate these exchanges. And I don't mean such things as money, but we produce things that others want to exchange with us for. So you might be producing shoes, or you might be growing apples or whatever it is, because people tend to want shoes or apples, and you produce those so that you can exchange with others and get something you want in return. And it doesn't matter if you like shoes or apples at all, really, as long as you think that there's value for others in producing those things, and that you are fairly good at producing them, or fairly good at figuring out what type of apple or what type of shoe or what have you, then you're going to make more and increase your own living standard more by producing something that you expect others to want even if you don't want it at all yourself. So that sort of creates an interdependence, if you will, or you could call it cooperation or coordination of people's actions, because we're all better off by serving each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And a key point here, when I should say, by the way, when I wrote my book, Per very graciously agreed to proofread it for me and go over it. And he gave me a lot of very helpful suggestions that I hope made the book better. You'll find out, reader, when you read it. And one of the key points that I did mention, but he asked me to emphasize it more. And I think that was a point worth emphasizing repeatedly in a discussion of a market, which is that the key property of the market is that now you're no longer producing for yourself and you're no longer producing for people you know. You're producing for people who could be all over the world, people you might never meet. And when you get to that point where you're able to produce something that is desired by people who don't know you, who have no reason to trade with you, that means you've effectively got it to a point of very high productivity. It's a lot higher productivity when you can focus on one thing, specialize in it, and sell to a large market of people, rather than focus on producing the things that you want, which are obviously plentiful and very difficult to specialize in.
Yeah, isn't it fantastic, really, when you think about it, that what we're talking about today, when people get a job and so forth, we talk about going to work. Well, that means that we're not at home working, right? Because we're not saying that when we clean our rooms or when we cook food at home or whatever, we're not working. That's not part of our vocabulary. Instead, we go to work. We even commute to work because the workplace is someone else, somewhere else than where we actually reside, where we live. Which was not the case throughout most of history, right? Because you lived on the farm and you got up early as heck in the morning and worked your ass off in the fields and with your animals and what else in order to feed your family. And then if there was surplus, then you sold it or you traded it with someone else and you might have needed some tools or whatever. And then you traded with a blacksmith to get those tools because they were handmade by your neighbor or in the next village or what have you. But you worked and you resided in the same place. Today, we're so used to that working is providing our input and our effort, our labor to producing for others that we don't even consider that something that is has to do with our lives at home, right? That we go to work, we do that someplace else, and that's a limited time of the day. Sure, it might be 8 hours a day, but still, it's a limited time of the day, and we do things that are not for us. We get payment for it. But we sort of understand this intuitively because even the language has changed, so we go to work. No one would have said that when they had breakfast or something on their home farm, their family farm, that they would say, I'm going to work. I'll see you later when they go out in the field or they go out to feed the horse or whatever. Of course not. That's not what they would say. It's a new way of phrasing things that we use today because everybody is working for everybody else. And what we're doing is something that we're fairly good at, we're good enough at, so that someone is willing to pay us for it, whether or not we use the product. And we don't even have a right to that product that we produce because we have sold it for salary in money.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is a very powerful idea. And I think this is one of the things that makes learning economics valuable. I said earlier, it makes it less likely for you to fall to demagogic and central planning ideas. And this one makes it, at least in my experience personally, I mean, learning in getting to really think deeply and profoundly about the division of labor and specialization was a great productivity hack because it really gets you to understand how it's essential for you to function in this extended order of the market, why you should aim to try and serve more and more people as much as you can. Because the more you serve, the more productive you are, the more output you can make, the more you benefit. And it's just simply getting this is just an enormously beneficial lesson. And it's one of those many, many things that, you know, when people ask me about what is the point of understanding economics, I think this is a great one because for the majority of people, the vast majority of people, they don't see the benefits that accrue to them from being part of the division of labor. You see, even relatively well-off and very successful people, a lot of them, they have this very popular these days idea of you know, we just want to get off the grid and grow our own food and be happy and be free. You see this and you hear it quite often. And, you know, many people do manage to pull it off. Eventually, you know, they make enough money and they decide they buy a plot of land and they start growing their own food. But a lot of people, when they do this, you know, they realize it's no picnic. It's no fun. It's a lot of hard work. Working a farm is not the romantic experience you imagined when you were in an office and you saw nice people at a farm on your Instagram and decided I wanted this. You know, you get a nice moment, a nice few moments every day, but the majority of your time on a farm is dealing with cow manure and putting up fences, and it's a terrible work in general. And when you try and conduct it at a small scale, when you try and conduct it on an individual scale, without economies of scale, without the ability to produce in large quantities and sell to other people, if you're just trying to do it yourself, it becomes enormously expensive, whatever it is that you try to do. If you're trying to grow crops or animals, you need to process them yourself. You need to handle all of their production on your own. It becomes extremely expensive compared to being part of the specialized order. So read your Austrian economics kids before you go and waste all of your money on trying to make it as a farmer and realizing why the vast majority of humans seek to leave the farm and go to the city.
There's an interesting TED talk with a guy producing his own toaster from scratch that I can recommend. I mean, it's a TED talk, so it's just 15 minutes, but he set out wanting to produce a toaster. It's just a simple home appliance, right? And you can get it in Walmart probably for less than $10 or something like that. It's no big deal. He wanted to make it from scratch, so without using the market and the division of labor and things like that. So he went ahead and he cheated quite a bit because he already had some tools and he used plastic that he melted and stuff like that. So he didn't actually produce everything from scratch, but he tried to the best of his ability to do that. And I think it took him 18 months and it cost him some $3,000 or $4,000 in order to produce it. And it almost worked once before it burned up. And that speaks just to your point. I mean, it's easier to see how animals, if they're happy or not, and if they produce milk or not, right? But just as such a simple appliance that we all take for granted, like the toaster, it's nothing fancy about it. It's not a computer or anything like that, right? It just heats bread. That's all it does. And still, you can't produce the freaking thing. It's simply impossible. And it's going to cost you so much time and so much money if you try to do it. And the result is going to be so much worse than that toaster for $9.99 in Walmart.
Yeah, I really think so many more people need to learn this lesson. I mean, a lot of people have this idea that, you know, society's evil, it's exploitative, it's bad for you, and you should just go out and do things on your own. And that'll be a lot easier, a lot better, a lot productive. It isn't. It's very, very difficult to make things on your own. The reason that we can have nice things, the reason all of these nice things in your life exist, is precisely because they are being produced by this gigantic order of the market where you have countless people all over the world cooperating to make that toaster. You know, when you think about what goes into that toaster, there's a bunch of metals that go into it. There's a bunch of plastic. All of that stuff is produced all over the world and sourced differently. And the company that makes the casing for the toaster will source its plastic from wherever they figure out is the best place to get it. And the people who are making the plastic are sourcing their raw materials, their oil and so on from wherever they find is the most efficient. And at every step on the way, everybody's is producing for large quantities. Nobody's just working so that they can make your own toaster on its own. So people are buying an enormous amount of oil in order to make plastics and to use all the other things that come out of oil. And then the plastic factory is preparing plastic casings for thousands of toasters and thousands of other objects. And then the toaster factory is getting the plastic casing and a bunch of other metals and electronics and stuff and putting them together in order to produce this thing. So if you try to do it on a scale of one on any of those things, it just becomes enormously expensive. And this is really the lesson that I think people need to learn. And a lot of people say, well, you know, capitalism is evil. You want to break out of the system. You want to be free. And you see this a lot because, you know, people mistake the problems of fiat money. They mistake the problems of inflation. They mistake the problems of a monetary system that is exploitative and abusive in a sense with capitalism, because, you know, the way that the monetary and banking system has managed to get where it is by pretending to be an inextricable part of capitalism. If you want capitalism, if you want trade, you must have a central bank that prints money to rob you. and you can't have one without the other. But in reality, you can and you should. You should have capitalism, because that's the only way that we can produce all of the modern technologies that we have. That's how we can have the standard of living that we have. But you shouldn't really have the inflation. That's the part that's bad. And it's I call it in Principles of Economics, I call it superpower. As a species, this is our superpower. You know, the lion, they have their claws and their teeth and they're fast. Different animals have different powers that allow them to hunt and survive and thrive. What we have, I think, the most amazing technology that we have, the most amazing evolutionary feature for us as a species is the market economy, is the ability to make infinitely cheap toasters where, you know, for most people in the world, they need to work for a few hours and they'll be able to afford a toaster or a pen or a pencil. It's what allows, you know, a 12-year-old girl who is in this division of labor can secure access to a gun that would allow her to kill the most powerful man alive or the most powerful animal alive with just one gun. She just pulls the trigger and that person is killed. So doesn't matter how strong you are, a 12-year-old who has access to the market economy can take you out. That's it. You could be, you know, the strongest, baddest murderer out there. And you think you don't need anybody because you're strong. Well, a 12-year-old girl can take you out because she has access to the market economy. And there's another example that I mentioned in my book. I think it was some guy in Oregon. He dropped out of society in Principles of Economics. I mentioned this example. He dropped out of society at some point. And he just decided he doesn't want to be part of society. And he went into the woods somewhere in Oregon. And then he just kept stealing. He'd always go to communities. He'd always make his way toward places where people lived. And he'd go into people's backyards and go into these places and pick up food. You know, he didn't steal money, but he'd need food because you need that to survive. And you know, going out in the desert, I think it's in Oregon, trying to make your way out in the, not desert, sorry, in the jungle in or in the forests of Oregon and trying to survive there and make your own food every day is just not an easy thing to pull off. And it's a lot easier to steal. And I think this is the perfect explanation for why all of this pretense that, you know, you don't need civilization is ridiculous. You do need civilization. Even as somebody who's isolated from civilization, the most productive use of your time is by far to go and prey on civilized people, steal their stuff, because it allows you access to infinitely higher productivity than whatever you can secure out there on your own.
Well, I mean, that's why politics is such a big business, right? That's what they do. And I think it is interesting. I mean, this guy, at least, he actually left society. He stole people's food. But usually you hear all these people who they argue very loudly against society and the market and the economy and they're pro-environment and I don't know what. And they say it's so much better if we would all just go back to nature and live our lives alone in the forests, because nature provides us with all that we need. Scarcity, they would even claim, is something that capitalists made up and forced down our throats. So nature is plentiful. We're only suffering scarcity today because of capitalists. What's funny with these people, ever since Rousseau back in his day, they have this romantic view of running out alone and naked in the forest, but they don't seem to do it. They all have the opportunity to do it. So Rousseau had the opportunity. There was plenty of forest. He could just go out and be the noble savage, right? And roam the earth and just enjoy, I suppose. He didn't. He really preferred his townhouse in Paris instead. And the same thing with all of these critics of civilization. They don't ever want to go first. Even though they are arguing not for communities in the forest, they're arguing for No, we should all be in the forest alone, and then we would meet up for whatever, fornication or whatever, when we feel like it. But other than that, we would just be happy roaming the forests. Why don't they? There's something that keeps them from it, and it can't be that they really want the next iPhone or something like that, because they want to turn their backs on all this stuff, right? And that's what they're arguing for. So why don't they do that? And it's the same thing with the depopulation crowd saying that we need to reduce the population of the Earth because we are a parasite on Mother Nature and on Earth, which is supposedly a creature itself or something. But they don't start themselves. They could easily be part of their own solution, but they're not. Instead, they keep on living and they seek healthcare and whatever else. They eat every day. They might even have children, some of them, which is just preposterous. If you're arguing that we should have fewer people on the earth, then why would you have children? That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And that's, I think, Ehrlich, who's been arguing for this crap since the 60s or something. I mean, he has a child, doesn't he? I think he does have a child, which is so hypocritical that it's mind-boggling how terribly different what they say is and what they do. And it's so hypocritical that I don't just want to punch the guy because it's such madness.
Yeah, although, I mean, to be fair, it's not entirely hypocritical if they think there's too many of you, but not too many of them. I mean, they're not saying that all humans are bad. They're just saying, us and the enlightened people like us, we think there's too many of you useless eaters out there. And therefore, we have ideas for how to get rid of you and join us on this journey of eliminating you. This is kind of where politics is. But no, you're absolutely right. This is so, this is true also in the case of the example of energy sources like fossil fuels, hydrocarbons. The people who are constantly talking about how hydrocarbons are evil are universally, at all times, always highly dependent on hydrocarbons in whichever form they are expressing their objections. So they're either online, which is completely dependent on hydrocarbons. You could never have computers or electricity or internet or any of that stuff without hydrocarbons. Or they're out there demonstrating wearing hydrocarbon clothes and using hydrocarbon for their signs. Or my favorite is when they tie themselves to things with these plastic handcuffs effectively that are made from hydrocarbons, or when they glue themselves to things that are also made from hydrocarbons. So even your stupid demonstrations are not possible without hydrocarbon. And similarly, you can apply that to capitalism. These people are out there demonstrating wearing clothes that they can only afford thanks to capitalism and the division of labor. If they wanted to just try and go off on their own, they'd be out there naked. Maybe they'd have a few leaves covering them. If they tried to rely on themselves and not rely on capitalism, they would be in pretty terrible shape very quickly. And yet they continue. Human Action has a great great paragraph on this. Probably the most brutal takedown of Nietzsche ever written. So Nietzsche, a lot of his work is all about how civilization is crushing the human soul and the human spirit. And, there's something noble about being a barbarian, being a savage, and that the world should be ruled by the strong and the weak should yield to the strong. And all of these ideas, I mean, obviously they appeal to something inside us. And that's why somebody like Nietzsche can attain some popularity. Like a lot of people, probably particularly men, do long for this kind of raw world of power where we fight with one another and, I don't have to respect you and I don't, if I don't like the way you look, then I just fight you to the death. And then I, get to enjoy living without having to look at you, or at least I die having tried to get rid of the enormous plight that is you not looking like I would like you to look. So this is kind of popular, but in reality, Nietzsche, Mises really, really brutally takes him down, saying Nietzsche was a pathetic weakling. He could only survive in places that had very specific climate. Like he could only live in one specific little town. And he would live there. So if he wanted to live in a world of dog eats dog or a world of people fighting based on their physical strength, he'd have been turned into toast very, very, very quickly. But I think the so obviously, you know, you look at people's actions and it is far more telling and revealing than the noises that they make to sell books. He chooses to live in civilization and he chooses to sell his books in civilization and he chooses to continue to benefit from all of the things that civilization makes for him. And I think the fatal flaw of people like Nietzsche in this regard, and a lot of people who don't understand economics and particularly who don't study the Austrians, is that they don't see, because they don't understand economics, they don't see the connection between us not being monsters at each other's throats and them having all the nice things that make their life possible. You know, Nietzsche being a sickling in his 50s, surviving in beautiful, civilized, modern city, being able to secure food and shelter and clothing and survive the winter when he was sick, is not something that could have been done in a world of the law of the jungle. It's something that can only happen with capitalist civilization. And that's why, if you actually, this is, I think, the really profound point, if you actually want to think of it in terms of power, if you think, you know, might is right, well, civilization is just the most powerful tool. It's really what makes us most powerful. So if it's, you know, in the same way that the lion will run and maul its enemy, what we as humans do in order to defeat our enemies is we gather together and work as a civilization and we trade and we build the division of labor. And that makes us far more powerful. And so therefore, the contradiction of people who seek to overthrow capitalism or overthrow civilization is that they long for a world of might makes right, but they don't understand that there is no might more powerful than the division of labor. So you can posture all you want about wanting to go out there and living in the nature and, you know, returning to the law of the jungle. But people who live by the law of the jungle are very trivial to deal with for people who live under capitalist civilization. We have guns. And you, if you really want to be, you know, meticulous about this, you're not going to have anything more advanced than rocks and sticks. And people who live under capitalist civilization can develop far more sophisticated weapons, which renders you and all of your posturing completely irrelevant. You're weaker if you don't get into civilization. All right. Well, we've hosted you before and we discussed entrepreneurship at length. And this is a topic of, this is a topic that you particularly like. So could you tell us why is entrepreneurship important and why is the Austrian school so concerned with entrepreneurship?
Well, I mean, the simple answer to that is simply that, well, what do entrepreneurs do? They create new ways or they figure out new ways of creating value for people. And since that is what the economy is all about, it's about figuring out how to create more value and raise people's standard of living because that's what they pay for. Then without entrepreneurship, there wouldn't really be anything that happened. So Mises calls it entrepreneurship the driving force of the market economy. And the, all the dynamism that we see around us, all the new goods or the, and the goods that disappear because we don't want them anymore, the new types of jobs and the new types of careers that emerge, all of these are created by entrepreneurs and their increased standard of living is generated by entrepreneurs, not because they want to raise our standard of living. I mean, maybe they do some of them, but what they're doing is figuring out ways to beat everybody else from the perspective of consumers. So, I mean, they're in the business of serving consumers and figuring out ways that that can make consumers even better off than they are already made. And therefore, the consumers will buy from them. And when that happens and they can keep their production costs low enough, I mean, then they will make a killing. They will make a lot of profit for as long as they can maintain that position, of course, because someone else will see what they're doing and copy what they're doing and maybe try to do it even better. So, I mean, entrepreneurship is really the value creation or new value creation, I should say, that goes on in the market economy. Unfortunately, there are so many different definitions of entrepreneurship that confuses the heck out of people. It's also, well, I wouldn't say that it confuses entrepreneurship scholars necessarily, but it's a a driver behind a lot of the scholarship that is published, because with all these different definitions, there's so much we can say in one way or the other. We can compare and contrast the definitions and the impact and the consequences of them and so forth, right? But I mean, Mises defined it simply as uncertainty bearing, which is very broad, because that just means that, well, anything you do in any action, that part that makes the outcome not perfectly predictable, that is entrepreneurship. So my going to the bathroom, it's something that is not very uncertain. I know how to do it. And I know what I'm aiming for, but there is some small chance that it's not going to work out. So I'm an entrepreneur when I go to the bathroom, according to this definition, which is of course so broad that it doesn't make any sense anymore. It's simply not helpful. So he instead says that there's a special kind that is called the entrepreneur promoter that I have focused some of my research on, trying to figure out what that is. It's sort of the disruptive entrepreneur, in a sense, the innovator who creates something new that either is a flop and no one even hears about it, or it completely changes how the world works. So a couple of examples of that would be Henry Ford. He did not invent the automobile in any sense, right? He just figured out a way to standardize production using assembly line manufacturing so that he could keep the cost so low that he could produce automobiles that were affordable to just normal people, middle-class people. Whereas before Henry Ford, they were automobiles, but automobiles were sort of tailor-made. So you ordered an automobile from an automobile manufacturer who basically had a group of carpenters and specialists, and they started working on your car and they produced it and then they delivered it to you, right? And that's, anybody can see that that's not a very efficient way to go about doing it. But no one had a better idea. And Henry Ford thought, well, if I can lower the price so much that it's affordable to the general masses, I think the automobile would be something that they would choose rather than horse and carriage. So he innovated that part, right? Made automobiles so standardized and cheap, and he could offer them at such a low price that it changed the world, right? And he standardized so much many people have heard him say, or not heard him say, but heard that he has said that you can get the Model T in any color you like as long as it's black, that sort of thing. So even the damn paint of the thing was standardized. So you just had one color. That was it. You couldn't get any other color just to keep the costs down. And he produced a car that a lot of people wanted. So people abandoned the horse and carriage, which meant a lot of people hired to breed horses, stable boys, to produce buggy whips, to produce those carts and all this stuff. They would go out of business because people were driving cars instead. So there you had sort of the Schumpeterian creative destruction, right? That Henry Ford created the affordable automobile so that people abandoned what they used before, the horse and carriage, and the creation of this new value, which was, of course, if people choose to get the automobile instead of horse and carriage, it's because they find greater value in it, and probably a lot greater value, so that they would gladly jump ship and go for the automobile instead. Well, that destroyed, in a sense, the prior industries that were not creating as much value. So the resources that they had tied up in whatever land and labor and whatever else they were using, the tools and what have you, they were instead released for new entrepreneurs to try new things. So you have this constant evolutionary process going on in the marketplace through, of course, a lot of people trading and exchanging and contributing their labor and their expertise. But also you have this special class of producers, the entrepreneurs, who rethink things and create things in novel ways, or create novel things that completely, when they're successful in a way, they will change consumers' behavior, because consumers will choose to shift their purchasing efforts toward those goods instead. And that will in turn lead to other things. Like the iPhone is another example of this type of innovation that changed things. And we take it for granted today, of course. But if you go back some 15 years, everybody had really tiny flip phones. And I think we talked about this last time too, that when the first iPhone was launched, it was a new way of thinking about the mobile phone. And it led to other things as well that completely disrupted things. So if you were in the early 2000s, say you were a really big player in the printed maps industry, well, someone figuring out a new mobile phone doesn't seem to affect you very much because people were using it for phone calls and maybe text messages, but nothing else. But then there was the iPhone, and suddenly there people had maps with navigation on their damn phones. So why would they need a printed map? So it completely destroyed your industry. So the prospect of selling printed maps and making a killing off of those, it simply doesn't exist anymore because people have free Google Maps or whatever in their phones. And that, of course, changes people's behavior too, that we're always connected and we can always communicate. I mean, you probably remember, many of the people listening might not, but when you were meeting friends on the town, when we were younger in our teens or whatever, well, you needed to set a place and a time and be there. Because if you weren't there, there was no freaking way of figuring out whether you were on your way or if you wouldn't show up, right? Because there was no way of contacting you, because we didn't have mobile phones. We all had only landlines. And of course, we could maybe go to a phone booth and use quarters and whatever and try to call, but then you would call home to the other person. So you don't know if that person was on their way to meet you or not anyway. So there was simply no way. You had to be very specific on where and when, and maybe even how long you were going to wait for that person before you actually go there, because there was no way. And now today, people were just on the fly say, oh, why don't we meet up? I'm somewhere around there anyway. And then you just maybe text each other or chat in some app until you're close, and the phone might even tell you that, oh, you're really close. So people behave in a very different way, and we get much more value out of our days because of all of these innovations that happen around us that we don't really think much about unless it's like new technology that we can see and touch and that we want to buy or something like that. But most of these things we don't think about, they just change our lives for the better daily, pretty much.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, Per, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for all of your insight on this. Again, well, tell us more about where people can find you and find your book. Also, the book is available for free, right?
Yeah, it is. I'm not a big believer in copyrights or anything like that. So you can download it, the PDF and the EPUB and the audiobook, both in English and in Spanish. They're available at the Mises.org website. And if you go to Mises.org/primer, you get straight to it. You can get it there. Then you can also buy it there, and it's like $5. There's a Kindle version, but you have to go to Amazon to do that. And that, I think it's like $3 or something like that, just to cover Amazon's fees or something like that. I am a little here and there online. I write for Mises.org, of course, but I'm also pretty active on Twitter, which is just my name, Per Byland. So hook me up there. I tweet every day, pretty much.
Okay, excellent. Well, we have another question for you. Somebody wanted to ask a question, so we're going to put them on before you go. Do you have a few more minutes?
Sure.
All right, David.
So my question is about fear and blindness. That's how I call the effect. When there is a lot of people in my environment, among my friends, who are really smart, like I would really consider them really intelligent people, engineers, doctors, whatever. And for some reason, I mean, I live in Germany. It's a fairly, it's a democracy, but it's fairly socialistic. And they have this kind of inefficiencies staring at them in the face. Like one of my favorite ones, I'm at the age where most of my friends have little children. They're getting old babies. And after 1 year, more or less, you start to look for a kindergarten place. Here in the south of Germany where I live, there is a huge shortage of kindergarten places. And people is completely, they're completely, they think it's completely normal that you have to apply to 50 different kindergartens, and you're just hoping that one takes you. And maybe they will take you, maybe they will not, maybe you will get a place 6 months later than you actually wanted to bring your child in kindergarten and then go to work again. They're frustrated by the fact they're not taken by the kindergartens. And then I always ask them, why do you think there is not enough places? And they said, well, I don't know. Like maybe the state should do something about it. And I said, okay, maybe the state should stop doing something about it, which is like limiting how much money you are allowed to pay for a kindergarten, because it's limited. I cannot just go to kindergarten and offer them the money that I want for them to take my child. There is a limit on what I can offer them for a place, and therefore there is a limit on what they can pay to their people working for them. And therefore, there are not enough people working for them. And there is a shortage of employees. There is not a shortage of school, there is a shortage of employees. But they somehow don't see it. They think, no. But if they say, if they did that, then there would be people who are, cannot afford a place. And I usually try to answer, yeah, but there would be enough places, you know, that must be a net positive. And these kind of situations, they repeat among my friends, my family. So my question is not only about the kindergartens. I would like to have your take, both of you, if you wish. Why do you think some people who are maybe have a good job, good status inside the fiat matrix are so blinded by it that even when the problems stare at them at the faces and knock at the door and spit in their face, more or less, they still don't see it. They still look ahead and they think, ah, must be something else.
Yeah, I've had the same problems many times with people but I think part of the problem is that they don't reason through it. They don't see the process of it. So they just think that things are there, and they've been taught that people are greedy. So were it not for the government, everything would be super expensive and everybody would suffer and be poor. So the state needs to be there to hold capitalists back. But of course, all you need to do to sort of crush that line of reasoning is that, well, okay, why would someone buy a product if it's more expensive than the value you get from it? Well, you wouldn't. Okay. So what you're saying is that they can't actually raise the price beyond what the value is for people. And wouldn't someone else benefit from offering more value at lower price? Yeah, they would. Aren't capitalists actually competing with each other to get people's money? Well, yeah, they are. And so, I mean, I think it really strikes at the core of the lack of economic literacy, simply because people are not thinking through these things. They're just assuming that it would be worse without the state, because the state says that the state is solving the problem, or at least helping solve the problem. And of course, we know that it's exactly the opposite. What they're doing is causing waste and raising prices and screwing things up, really. I'm not sure if there is a quick fix for this. I mean, giving them a copy of my book, maybe, but the problem is not only the understanding, because they would probably understand if you talk to them and walk the way through the logic and help them think it through, then they would understand it, but they would just fail to apply it on any other situation, right? And of course they would forget it. So next time you meet them, they're going to complain about the same thing again. At least that's my experience. So I'm not sure how to get around this and solve that problem, because it's sort of a miseducation of people, that especially, I think, people who have been highly educated, they have learned certain things and they're stuck in certain truths, quote unquote. And then they just use those as shorthands or templates for how to think about things. And then they focus on some other things instead. Because I think if you ask anyone who is, say, a labor worker who's starting their own firm or something like that, as a carpenter or whatever, a plumber, they all realize how it actually works because they're exposed to the market. And I think a lot of the problems that we have today are really caused by keeping people out of the market. So exposing people to the market, of course, I'm not sure how you could expose your friends to the market. But society in general, I think through the state, protects people from actually interacting in the market, because you're not actually selling your labor in an open market. You're not getting paid for your personal contribution, because there are regulations in place, there are labor unions and all this stuff. And of course, entrepreneurs can't start new businesses because that's regulated too. So it's sort of almost a static system, and there you are. You're one of the pawns in the game. Whereas I think back in the day when people were farmers, they were not very well off, but if they wanted to buy something or sell something, well, they were in the market and they understood immediately what they would need to do in order to get a deal out of it and actually exchange. We take that for granted today. So I have no solution for your friends. I mean, it's super frustrating. I think that is a huge problem in society overall, especially Western society, because people are simply not exposed to the market forces, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, I think and from my perspective, I think the reason to be hopeful about all of this stuff, the only reason to be hopeful is the internet allowing for the spread of knowledge. And that's really making a difference, because these kind of ideas, you know, yes, the vast majority of people haven't thought about these kind of things, but the people who have, the people who fall down the rabbit hole of reading Austrian economics and figuring it out, they just don't shut up about it. They tend to get it. It tends to work for them. It tends to make their life better because they understand how the world works in a much less insane way than people who watch TV. And they serve as, you know, either you tell people things and then they listen to you, or they, the hard way, you know, they keep doing bad things and watch you not fall for the same traps that they fall in. And then eventually start to become wiser about these things. So on the one hand, we have knowledge, and on the other hand, we have Bitcoin. I think this is really the other thing, because it's going to put everybody on a stricter financial routine, relatively speaking, because as it continues to grow, people who live in a Bitcoin mindset, who live in a Bitcoin world, who deal with Bitcoin, are going to witness their life turn out better, I imagine, in the long run, than people who are going to continue to be plugged into the matrix, believing the propaganda, believing all of those things, because, you know, the point of the matrix is to take advantage of you. So I think we're, you know, if I were to be optimistic in the long-term view, it would be just that the knowledge is out there, and now we have a strong incentive for people to learn the correct way of dealing with this stuff because of the way that Bitcoin just enforces financial and fiscal responsibility on people and governments and individuals along the way. So maybe there is something to be optimistic about. And I like how almost with every episode here in the Bitcoin Standard podcast, we always, it's like a cartoon where there's a lesson at the end, but the lesson is always that Bitcoin fixes everything. So excellent. We arrived at that conclusion, and that is a good time for us to end. Thank you, Per. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll stay in touch. Take care.